3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Monday Morning Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 a.m. I'm Rob, and for the next 90 minutes, we'll be bringing you current affairs that diverges from the news reported on by the mainstream media. The show you just heard before this was a repeat of the Think Again show, which airs on Friday mornings, I believe. Yeah, Friday mornings. There it is. Such an amazing show, and really awesome to hear their commentary every morning as I come into the station. Actually segues really nicely into an article that I was reading over the weekend about Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel trying to blackmail the Clinton administration back in the late 90s, early 2000s, to try to leverage the release of a U.S. naval official, Jonathan Pollard, who was arrested for leaking information to Israel. In this book that Daniel Halper wrote, it reveals that Benjamin Netanyahu told the Clinton administration that they were listening to his phone calls between Clinton and his intern Monica Lewinsky, and they were threatening to release that and other information to try to get the release of Jonathan Pollard. So, and that was back in the late 90s, right? So it's interesting to think that even then, the stronghold of Israel's lobbying of the US was existing and strong, clearly. And it really makes me curious now as to what that lobbying looks like now and how that relates to Australia's involvement in all of this. Obviously, it's not really a surprise that the Australian government follows where the US government wants to go and wants to bomb, especially because, weapons companies all across the continent make a lot of money from this, and also now with the rise of fuel prices, fuel companies are making a lot of money. Hope everyone has had a really good weekend. It was really warm, really, really surprisingly warm yesterday. I feel like it's the last burst, hopefully the last burst of hot weather. And so it was nice to have a little sun. I was a very busy little person over the weekend, and by Sunday I ran out of steam. But I did make seitan for maybe the fifth time, and for those of you who have made it before, I don't know, like the texture, getting the perfect texture of seitan still eludes me. I think I'm getting better, but the line between you've over-kneaded it and you've under-kneaded it is just, it's so thin. But I think I'm getting better. And I mean, that's the real win, right? trying new things and getting better every time. Anyway, I'll just give a quick rundown because otherwise I'll get lost talking about Satan for 90 minutes. We're going to start off the show after our headlines hearing the second half of a conversation that my co-host Hannah helped record with Rosie Ganino. Speaking with Alva Geeky, if you didn't tune in last week, Alva Geeky is a 90-year-old feminist activist and one of the first four women who started the women's liberation movement back in the 70s here in Nam. The first half was amazing, and I encourage listeners to go back and listen to the first half at 3cr.org.au/Monday-breakfast. So they're speaking about the early days of the movement, fighting for women's rights, being housemates with another feminist activist icon, Zelda Diaprano, and so many other things. And following that, we're going to be listening to the first episode of a podcast called What Children Know, produced by Alvy Swan here in Nam, which is a bunch of interviews from young people speaking at rallies, drama classes, music camps, and living rooms. This first episode is includes interviews from children at Palestinian rallies. So, we'll be playing that after the conversation with Alva Geeky, and we're really grateful to have permission to be playing that on the show. And following that, we're going to round out the show with some speeches from yesterday's March for Forests, hosted by the Bob Brown Foundation. So we're going to be hearing a few different speeches there before the end of the show. And I'll mention it again later, but a huge thank you to Marissa from the Doin' Time Show for recording and editing and providing the audio from that show for us in a very quick turnaround, in the heat as well. So with that, I will get onto our headlines for this week. Stay tuned.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty. Now one, two, nitty gritty night.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show for Monday, the 23rd of March, 2026. And these are the news headlines. For the first time in 13 years, Victorian public school teachers and education support staff are preparing to strike following a 98% vote in favour of industrial action by members of the Australian Education Union. Union leaders say the Allan government's latest offer fails to address growing workloads, staff shortages, and systemic underfunding across the public system. The AEU Victorian President Justin Mullally said the dispute goes far beyond wages, pointing to a deepening workforce crisis. Justin said, quote, "Our members are telling us they cannot keep up with the workload demands being placed on them," end quote. And they also said, quote, "This is about securing the future of public education and making sure schools are fully resourced. We need meaningful action on workload and funding, not just rhetoric about being the quote-unquote education state," end quote. That's Justin Mullally, Victorian President of the AEU. Also in news this week, residents fighting the demolition of Melbourne's public housing towers are preparing to escalate their legal challenge to the High Court after a setback in the Court of Appeal. The case, supported by Inner Melbourne Community Legal, centres on the legality and human impact of the Victorian government's redevelopment plans. the government, through Homes Victoria, has argued the towers are no longer fit for purpose, citing a $2.3 billion maintenance backlog. But advocates say the redevelopment risks displacing thousands of residents and dismantling long-standing communities. Inner Melbourne Community Legal CEO Lucy Adams said the case raises fundamental questions about housing rights. Lucy Adams said, quote, "This is about whether the government can displace entire communities without proper consultation or legal safeguards," end quote. Adams continued, quote, "Residents deserve certainty, dignity, and a genuine say in their future. Public housing is essential infrastructure, not a disposable asset," end quote. In other news this week, a major audit has found that the New South Wales government is failing to support First Nations people both in and out of prison. The state's Auditor General said the activities of New South Wales Corrective Services and Youth Justice have, quote, "had little to no impact on the rates of reoffending among First Nations people," end quote. The report cites an absence of, quote, "effective, efficient, and culturally appropriate rehabilitation services," end quote, which as a result is perpetuating a cycle of reoffending. While the New South Wales government has invested into support initiatives for First Nations people, the agencies do not monitor the outcomes or the amount spent on said initiatives. The government body has also not actioned their closing the gap requirements, the Auditor General's report found. And finally, in the news this week, a formal apology from the independent, broad-based Anti-Corruption Commission has reignited debate about police oversight in Victoria after the watchdog acknowledged failures in its handling of a complaint against Victoria Police. While the apology marks a rare admission of wrongdoing, advocates say it highlights systemic problems in accountability mechanisms. The Police Accountability Project at the Flemington and Kensington Community Legal Centre has long argued for stronger independent oversight of policing. Project lead Tamara Lee said the case reflects broader concerns. Tamara Lee said, quote, "This apology shows that the current system is not working for people who experience police misconduct," Lee said, and end quote. They continued with, quote, "There needs to be independent, transparent oversight that communities can trust. Without structural reform, these issues will continue to repeat." These have been the news headlines for Monday, the 23rd of March, sorry. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
"3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That song is called Magic by Strong Boy. One word. We are now going to hear the second half of a conversation between Rosie Ganino and Alva Gigi, which we played last week. We played the first half last week, sorry. For those of you who went there, Alva Gigi is a 90-year-old feminist activist and was one of the first four women who started the women's liberation movement in the 70s here in Nam. Yeah, it's such an amazing conversation talking about the early days of the movement, struggling with misogyny in the left, being housemates with Zelda Diaprano, and yeah, so much more. Here's the second half of the conversation.
Did things change for the movement when Elizabeth Reid was forced to resign, and then not long after that, the Whitlam government was kicked out?
Well, it did, but as I said, you know, we were so busy doing what we wanted to do, and because a lot of women at the movement didn't take much, a huge amount of faith in what government could do and would do, it wasn't as dramatic as you might have thought, although we were, you know, there were demonstrations against, what was his name? Malcolm Turnbull. Malcolm Fraser. Yes. So, that was the sort of situation. And we were so busy, you know. We had so many activity groups going on, and some of the women, they worked tirelessly. You know, the women who got women into shelters and the women who ran the women's health centre. Now, Bon was very involved in the women's health centre and also the working women's group. So she did a lot. And so those women, they were working so hard, you know. They really worked, you know, 24 hours a day for no money, some of them.
Yeah, so maybe it was just as well there was that underlying view of Femocrats, as you said, because, you know, you might be able to rely on a particular government for a short time, but it's certainly not governments are certainly not to be relied on in the long term.
That's true.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that she probably did a lot of good, and I'm sure that she would have been outspoken within Labor Party, well, government, when Whitlam was in, and changed a lot of people's attitudes. Now, whether she changed Whitlam or he was already changed, I'm not sure, but he certainly got what we're on about.
Yeah. Given that he even wanted to appoint a woman in that position, I suppose, is a good sign from the start.
And then he put millions into the Women's Conference, the International Women's Women Politics Conference in 1975 in Canberra. And women from all over Australia were invited, from the YWCA, from the CWA, all sorts of groups were invited, people, and people from overseas as well. And they gave papers, and it was a wonderful time, actually, except, of course, the press were against this, spending all that money on women. And the Canberra Times, we had a demonstration to the Canberra Times. We had a sit-in there because they were giving us such a bad rap at the conference. So it got a bad rap from a lot of people. But, you know, it did a lot of good. There were lots of groups grew out of it too.
I suppose it's not surprising it got a lot of bad rap from the press, because certainly at the time the press was made up of mostly men.
Yes, there were a few good reporters. Claudia Wright was one of them.
Yep.
And there was a lady who used to write the women's column. Unfortunately, I've forgotten her name, but... We got a terrible time from the press. You know, I remember we had I think it was 71, we had our first pro-abortion demonstration, and there were about 500 women, because we used to count them, you know, get a vague idea of how many were there. And I think there were about 500 women, and the press hardly mentioned it at all, the demonstration. And then one of them said, about 200 barefooted women marched through the streets of Melbourne against the abortion laws.
Isn't, Isn't it funny how being a barefooted or a hippie is supposed to be such a negative thing? Because now,
it sort of was, because you know, in the 60s and also in the early 70s, when you went into the city, it was a big deal for women. They wore stockings and gloves and hats and their best clothes. Yep. And so when we were on demonstrations, there was nobody hardly in a dress unless it was a hippie sort of a dress.
Yep.
And some of them didn't have a bra on, but most of us did. And there was hardly a lipstick amongst us, but there were a few. And so we were much more colourful, you know, than the average woman who was, you know, uptight with her girdle on.
Yes. And were any of you or many of you actually barefooted?
I don't remember. I certainly wasn't. It would hurt. I didn't want that, thanks.
Was there any man who was particularly supportive in the press or in public life?
Not that I remember.
Oh, interesting.
There probably was. There was some sort of a bit in both camps, you know. And what they hated most was not being allowed to come to our meetings or our demonstrations. Yeah. That really riled them.
A bit of their own medicine. They didn't like it.
Oh, yeah. No, that was really a no-no for them. That's why they were so. That was one of the reasons they were so anti, because they just weren't allowed in. I remember we had a big Australia-wide conference end of 71, and there was a man came in and sat in a chair and he wouldn't leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, if you have a vote and vote against me, then I'll go. But it took him a long time, so we did have a vote and threw him out. But of course, that causes another anti women's liberation report in the page in the reviews.
Yeah. Well, I guess that they should really understand what it's like to exclude people, considering women weren't allowed to drink in bars.
That's right.
Yeah.
I talk about some of the things that we actually did in those first couple of years?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, in WAC, the Women's Action Committee, we started off pretty early because we were action group. We weren't a discussion group. Because I think probably because we were mainly older than the ones that started in groups around Australia, around Melbourne, and we were sort of, I think Bond was in her 50s, Zelda was in her 40s, and Thelma and I were in our 30s, and most of the other women who came were 30s and 40s, I think. And the women that were in the groups around the university, of course, they were in their 20s, early 20s. So we were an action group. We weren't a discussion group. And so the first thing we did was we had a pub crawl, and we got thrown out of two pubs, and they said there were no – one of the excuses was there were no toilets. That's always a good one. There are no toilets for women. And they'd get the police if we didn't go. So we went to three. The last one took us in. That was the first demo. Then we had one – this is only WAC, mind you, and only four or five of us. We had a demonstration on the balcony of the, what's that hall in Victoria Street? I'll think of it later. Anyway, it's a big hall, and we had a demonstration against the Miss Teenage Quest because we didn't agree with that sort of thing. And then we had, we went on, the one that's advertised a lot and it does seem to get people's imaginations is we went on it on tram, couple of tram rides, and we wanted to pay three quarters of the fare because women only got three quarters of a wage, and we got a children's ticket given to us. We got threatened with taking us to court afterwards, but that never happened. And so that was WAC. That was how we got going. And then of course the other groups, as I said in the beginning, they were mainly discussion groups around the uni and Carlton, but they eventually joined us. And by 1971, there were enough groups in Melbourne to start having a meeting together. So we had meetings once a month, I think. And then, of course, at the beginning of 72, we got enough people together to pay for a centre in Little La Trobe Street.
Right.
And then, of course, we had more demonstrations after that as well.
Fantastic.
So it was an interesting time. It was a little bit worrying, but it was, we had right on our side, we
Absolutely.
Thought.
Absolutely. And such clever and actions that were really right to the point, that really would be very hard to argue against, like three-quarter pay that men get, so pay three-quarters of the fare. Amazing. Did you all think of the actions together, or how did you come up with those ideas?
More or less. I mean, Zelda thought of a few because she'd been in the union and fighting in the union for 30 years or so, whereas, you know, the unions, the teachers' unions was fairly quiet, although there was a women's group started up within the union, and that got poo-pooed within the union too. And, I mean, Zelda did think of a few, but we all sat round and decided what we wanted to do. Unfortunately, many of the women wouldn't join us because, this is in WAC, because they were too frightened, you know, they'd never done anything like it. And they just weren't confident enough.
Yep.
So it usually ended up four or five of us in the demonstrations.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
Yep. It sounds like a lot of fun, actually. Was it fun or was it a lot of
it
fairly scary?
It was fun. No, it wasn't that scary. Yep. I mean, we just thought we were right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. When you know that you're right, it's so much easier to be, to do things that would normally take a lot of bravery.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just getting back to Zelda, as I'm sure you know, there's a Zelda Di Prano statue standing outside Trades Hall in Melbourne.
Yes.
As a monument to her outstanding contribution towards equal pay and rights for women. And the statue depicts Zelda with a large chain around her waist, as she was when she first chained and padlocked herself to the doors of a government building, which hindered the entrance and exit of workers. I like the way she says that the workers had to sort of bend right down and squat to walk under the chains. Must have been a lot of fun. Now, we've got some new anti-protest laws recently passed in Victoria, in line with all the other states, and they're pretty draconian and just getting worse and worse. Under those laws, it would be a crime to use chains and lock-on devices in a peaceful protest. And in fact, I think it's even a crime to carry them if you're under suspicion that you might be using them in a protest. It's, you know, really pretty insane, and there's a lot of groups trying to fight against those laws. What do you think about this, and what do you reckon Zelda would have said if she were here now?
I live in northern New South Wales, so we didn't get that information here that I know of. I listened to the ABC, and I don't think it was on the ABC because, you know, it's all very state-centred, a lot of this stuff. You know, they don't spread it around unless there's a bomb or something. And so, look, all I can think of is that Zelda would have thought that was anti-equality. You know, if you can't protest in a country for the things that you believe in without bombs, you know, I'm not talking about people who want to blow things up, but I'm talking about peaceful protest, then you're losing out on democracy, really. And I think Zelda would not have approved of it, but I mean, obviously I can't speak for her. Now, did you mention something about putting an apron on her and somebody protested about that?
I did, yes. I don't know how well publicised it was. I don't think the media, certainly in Victoria, pays too much attention to things unless there's some excitement or arrests happening. But I thought it was a really clever thing to do, a group of women activists put an apron on the statue of Grace of Zelda on a couple of days before International Women's Day, and the apron had printed on it "Difficult Woman," obviously referring to what Grace what was said about Grace Tame by the Prime Minister. I think that was a great thing, and not that I knew Zelda, but I reckon she'd have a good old giggle about that and would approve.
Well, I think she would have laughed at the apron, because, of course, that was exactly what we wanted to get away from.
Yeah, yep.
So I think she would have seen the irony. Zelda had a wonderful sense of humour. We'd had lots of laughs. People, you know, are sour old women's liberationists. Yeah. And we weren't sour at all. We had lots of great fun. Yeah. You know, we laughed and we just laughed at the irony of things, and and that it spurred us on, you know, that sort of stuff. But goodness me, I don't think she'd have worried about wearing an apron. She just laughed.
No, well, there were certain members of the community who were very upset about that.
Well, it's not as if they're going to paint something on her.
No,
I mean,
exactly.
I don't believe in defacing statues, and I don't believe in knocking them over either. Mm. And if you don't believe in the philosophy, then you have to put a sign that says the truth.
Mm.
You know, for example, statues of Captain Cook, as far as I'm concerned, they stay.
Mm.
But if you want to, you can write the truth underneath it. Actually, what happened to Captain Cook when Captain Cook came here?
Yeah.
Or the white people came and took over.
Mm.
So, yeah, I don't believe in defacing statues or pulling them down, but I'm in an apron. Goodness me, that takes 2 seconds to get it off.
Exactly.
You don't want it there.
No.
3CR.
If you've just tuned in, we're bringing you an interview with Alva Geeky, one of the significant activists in the early days of the women's lib movement from the 70s here in Nam. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR. Stay tuned.
Okay, now you've written a couple of volumes on the history of the women's liberation movement, and I know they're available. There are not many copies printed, so they're available to read in the state library and a couple of universities, I think, which I think would be really interesting, because I think at the time you wrote it, there wasn't any history of the women's liberation movement written, which is pretty amazing for such a significant and sort of revolutionary movement.
Well, the funny thing was that there are lots of books written, and some of them ignore Melbourne altogether, and they concentrate on Sydney, and I don't know why, but mostly they're written by maybe Sydney and Canberra people, I'm not sure. Some of them mention Canberra quite a lot, that group.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them mention Adelaide. They hardly mention Melbourne at all, the ones that I've looked at. Mm-hmm. And so the one I wrote was based on the archives that I brought up here from Melbourne. As I said, I brought quite a lot up here. And the first one was called The Women's Action Committee and the Women's Liberation Movement, Melbourne, 1969 to 1972. And it's in two volumes. And the second volume is a lot of photos from the time. The first volume is generally about the WAC and the general women's liberation, how it got going, etc. And the second one also, as well as photos, it's got a few profiles and interviews that I did with people when I lived in Melbourne. So that one was just printed by me locally here, and there are only about 7 copies made, I think, altogether. A couple of people have got private ones, and the others are in the libraries, the State Library and the Melbourne University, but they're only in the archives, so you can't take them out.
Sure.
Now, the next one I didn't write. It's actually an anthology. And we're looking for a publisher at the moment, actually, but we think it's wonderful. It's got 22 stories by 22 women who were actually involved in the movement in the 70s, 80s and 90s in Melbourne. And it talks about their work in the movement, how they got involved, talks about their families, talks about how they got involved, why they got involved, what they did in the movement, and what they did after the shouting stopped, you know.
Yep.
Because we were a very noisy lot until about 2000, and then, of course, people got involved in other things.
Mm.
And honestly, the things that these women did after 2000 are just wonderful. One person made films on women. One person started a printing press and only printed feminist-type information books. Look, it's just incredible. Some of them were involved in helping migrants, et cetera, et cetera. So the end of my story, I wrote, once a feminist, always a feminist, and I think that sort of sums us up.
Yep, fantastic.
Because, you know, we really were. Anyway, we haven't got a name for that one yet, but it will be something like Women's Liberation, the Second Wave of Feminism, something like that. Because that will depend a lot when we get a publisher, because we have to cooperate with them on a name as well as many other things. And we're hoping that we will get a lot of photos into it as well, because I'm a visual person and I think every picture tells a story. And there are some wonderful things there, wonderful photos. So it's going to be really interesting, I think. And so all we need now is somebody to publish it for us.
And when you do find a publisher, and I'm sure you will, and in fact there might be some people in the literary world listening to 3CR right now who know just the person or who are the person. So, yeah, if anybody's listening who's a publisher or involved in publishing, give Alva a call. And I hopefully it will be there'll be lots of copies published. Is that your plan? Because I, for one, would love to buy one.
Yeah, we're sort of thinking about 2,000 at this stage, but it also depends on the publisher, I guess. And
great. Well, I'm really looking forward to reading that, and I love, like I think a lot of people do, photos. You know, from the time, and you, as you said, photos really tell 1,000 stories or some expression like that.
The only problem with the photos is, and you'll find that a lot of women's books, women's liberation books and feminist books don't have photos because they cost a lot of money.
Right, yeah.
You know, they cost extra because the pages have to be really good quality.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're differently and all sorts of things. So that's the problem with photos, but we're hoping that we will get enough money and we will be able to publish it.
Have you applied for a government grant for the book?
No, if you know anybody who knows how to do that, then we would be interested in that as well.
Oh, well, the 3CR community will put our heads together and see what we can come up with.
And and hurry up, because I'm 90 and I'd like to see them published before then.
Right, okay.
Before I leave this wonderful place that we're in.
Doesn't sound like you'll be doing that anytime soon.
Hope not to.
As they say,
too much to do.
Old feminists never die.
This is true.
Yes.
They fade away.
They don't fade away. They, I don't know. We'll think of something to end that little axiom. Okay, is there anything else that you'd like to say?
Not really. You did mention to me once that Bond wasn't mentioned a lot.
Yeah, that's right.
I really would like to put in a plug for Bond because, in fact, she was a wonderful person. She was very empathetic to everybody. She did a lot for women's health in that women's health group. She wrote lots of letters to the paper in the early days about all sorts of things, and she had a pseudonym. I think it was called Mary Miller. And Zelda had a pseudonym as well, because they thought that they wouldn't be able to get published every week. They wrote so many letters. Gave lots and lots of speeches, and she wrote a book called In Our Own Hands, which was all about women's health. And she was also involved in the working women's group that we had going too. So she's not forgotten by us, and I can tell you that there are many in the movement who remember her very fondly.
Great.
She was a good person.
Yeah, amazing. Sounds like there were a lot of you very, very good people that we should all be very grateful to. All right, well, we might finish it there. Thank you so much for talking to us. That was so interesting. And as I said before, Brazen Hussies, which is a documentary available on ABC iView, in which you feature Alva. It's such a great film, so entertaining and so informative. So I suggest men and women should all watch it. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Look, I mean, it's not something I do every day, and it's not something I'm terribly good at, but, you know, I think the more we get the word out, because, you know, it's so important that people know about what happened in the past so that they can build on it, you know. I mean, a lot of people are building on it.
Exactly.
And, you know, the more women build on it, then the better it will be for all of us.
Absolutely, because as we all know, there's still a long way to go before we get equality with men.
I know. And
I reckon until there is equality, the world's going to continue to be a pretty problematic place for the general population.
Yes, all right. Well, from one difficult woman to another, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you so much.
Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Trans Family are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. Trans Family is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on the dial. Also streaming live on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au and as we commonly play in announcements on the Community Radio Plus app, which is actually such a wonderful way to listen to 3CR no matter where you are, as long as you have a little internet signal. That was the second half of a conversation between Rosie Ganino and Alva Gigi, who is a 90-year-old feminist activist and one of the co-founders of the Women's Action Committee and an icon of the women's liberation movement in the 70s here in Nam. You can listen to the first half of that interview on last week's show at 3cr.org.au/Monday-breakfast. We're now going to hear an excerpt of the first episode of the podcast What Children Know, produced by Alvy Swan here in Nam, which talks about what children know. And this first episode focuses on resistance and why to do it, and features a bunch of interviews from children at the weekly Free Palestine rallies that took place over the last few years. Thank you to Alvy Swan for allowing us to replay a little bit of this podcast. So without further ado, here it is.
I'd get there at 11 to start setting up sound equipment.
This has been happening every week.
Take lollipops. You need energy. You are leading from the front. Thank you for joining.
Since October 2024.
Yeah. So there's no reversing, of course.
No way.
Yeah.
We go forward, we don't go backwards.
Yes.
I'd often be pushing the sound trolley, which is a precarious arrangement of speaker horns up on long poles. And in front of me, there'd be Aisha. Aisha's 11, and she's always leading the chants. She'd often be lifted up on her uncle's shoulders, chanting into the microphone. She's been to nearly every Palestine protest on these Sundays. She talks about the beautiful community that's formed here.
I've made friends from like different cultures and backgrounds, and it's really nice because I get to discover more about different people's like culture, behind their history, their foods, like Yeah, and it's really rich. Like, everyone's culture is really rich. Yeah. I feel like they're just like my brothers and sisters. Like, every time I see someone, I'm just like, hi, how are you? Like, because I know them all, and I just feel like we're just connected.
Yeah. And this is Zia, who's 11, and Attila, who's 9.
You know, usually I'm stuck at home and I always just want to see him. The only times I get to see him is sometimes, like, on Friday I go to, like, the mosque and I see him there. And, like, we listen to some lectures.
Yeah.
That's, like, the only time I get to see him. And that's why whenever there's rallies, I always ask, is he coming to it? Like, I ask my parents. Because I always want to see him. Like, he's like one of my favourite cousins.
Did you two meet here? Huh, but you're cousins?
Yeah, we're cousins.
But you met here?
No, we're cousins.
No, not me. No, like, when did we meet?
No, you, like, when we're...
Oh, yeah, we're cousins.
Like, when you were a baby. When you were a baby. You know how old I'm, like...
I think October 7th, yeah, there was a night protest and they read out all the babies under one and it was a lot of names. Yeah, it made me feel really, like, separated and alone. Like, it made me think, like, if I was there and that happened to me.
Two chairs and a table. Think, like, say, if you want to do something else, like, if you want to play Lego, for example, and I want to play with...
the 3D printer. We just let's just say,
yeah, we'll just say, what if we do that for a bit and then we do that, but if we don't have enough time, we'd say...
We'll do it another day.
Yeah, we'll either do it another day.
Do you think if we did more things together...
It would be much more better.
We'll be much more connected, like, as a community, like... Connected, like, together. We won't have as much wars or as much fights. We'll just be more, like, calm and stuff. Like,
make friends.
Yeah, it would be much easier. And, like, no one would be teasing. There wouldn't be a lot of those bad stuff going on, you know? Like,
yeah, like... No fighting.
Like, if there was royal peace. And also, everyone's ideas...
Yeah, because
everyone's ideas are different. Humans can make ideas for themselves and you don't have to follow it. Just like saying, if someone's a Christian and someone's a Muslim, you don't...
They can still be friends.
You can give them information about being a Muslim and what it is, but you don't have to... That you don't force them to do it. You just give them information, or if they want to know something about it, you can tell them, and like it's just better. Like, you don't have to follow every single one's, like, you don't have to follow everyone's ideas, but you can listen to it, you know?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Abeda.
And how old are you?
10.
And firstly, what's your favourite animal?
Probably peregrine falcon. Like, if I say to my son when I grow up, you have to be an engineer. Or what I have to be. No, be yourself. I would never do that. Let my child be them. Be them. Like, then you learn, like, what to do in life. Not learn, but, like, if they were to do that, because they might be extremely good at something, but you're forcing to do something that they're really bad at. That could happen. If they want to be a soccer player, be a soccer player.
Yeah.
If they want to clean the toilets, clean the toilets. Be yourself. Do whatever you want. Like, you know that president thingy, that guy? Yeah, Israel and stuff. Yeah, they're forcing these Israel people to, like, kill him, whatever. But, like, that's not good. Like, be themselves. Like, I'm a president and I'm Palestinian, yeah? And next to me there's Israel, like he supports Israel, yeah? And I force him to be Palestinian. Nah, I can't do that. Be yourself, even if he's Israeli. I don't care. Be yourself. I can't force... Come, you're not Palestinian anymore. You're Israeli now. No. Yeah. That's not good.
Yeah.
This is serious. Like, if children die,
in the world. Like, it's something that we should stop and we should acknowledge. Something very bad is happening and we need to stop it. That's how I feel.
That was a very short excerpt of from the podcast What Children Know, made by Alvy Swan here in Nam, featuring interviews with children at the Palestine protests over the last couple of years. We'll put the link to the podcast and this episode in the show notes for the podcast of this show that we upload after the show. And what a beautiful little excerpt that is. And yeah, definitely listen to, there's three episodes currently out, definitely listen to all of them. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, and we're now going to hear some speeches and a little interview from yesterday's March for Forests, hosted by the Bob Brown Foundation. Again, thank you so much to Marissa from the Doing Time show for recording and providing new audio in very, very tight turnaround in the heat all by herself. So, yeah, it was amazing to be able to get that audio for today's show just, 24 hours after it took place. Anyway, we're going to start off with hearing an interview that Marissa did with the MC of the rally and one of the organizers of the rally, Violet Coco. Here it is.
We are at the March for Forests with the Bob Brown Foundation and the wider community of Nam. And I am Violet Coco, and we are here gathering with thousands of people to say we must protect native forests. We've got some incredible speakers today, like Yaron Bundle, who is the firekeeper at Camp Sovereignty, and an amazing First Nations woman, who Gunta Jimara and Ewan and Bidjara, and she is also the founder of SOPEC, the Southern Ocean Protection Embassy Collective, and a mother of five. We have Gab Devitri coming, we've got Ollie from School Strike for Climate, we've got Iza Majira from Indonesia to talk to us about the international community of forests. We've got Phil Zystra, who is a fire manager academic, who knows all about how forests interact with fire. And today we're going to be educating each other, we're going to be sharing courage, and we are going to be demanding that we protect native forests.
So, with the native forests, is logging still happening all over Australia?
All over Australia, forests are being decimated, and a lot of those forests are being taken overseas, or they're being burnt for fuel, which is just a horrific use of these ancient and essential ecosystems. Here in Victoria, we have forests, they declared a few years ago that they have ended native forest logging, and yet they're actually extracting more forest than ever under the guise of fire breaks. So it is essential that we really demand that we protect these native forests so there are no loopholes.
What sort of loopholes would there be?
Well, basically, because they're saying that they're creating these fire breaks, which actually make our forest more flammable, because the older a forest is, the less flammable it is. So if you destroy a bunch of forest, then it actually becomes more flammable, which is what we're going to hear from Phil Zystra today. But because they're putting it under this guise of fire break, it actually bypasses all the environmental protection that forest defenders have really fought hard for over the last few decades.
I'm not sure if you know Judy Barry, who was an amazing warrior over in America, who did a lot of work for the movement.
I haven't heard of that name. Please educate me.
Yeah, Judy Barry was actually someone who worked a lot with the loggers and the logger corporations, and she was very much against clear felling, and we'll talk about clear felling in a minute, but she was actually trying to advocate selective logging.
Okay, yeah, wow. Well, I think, it's we've come a long way in our understanding of how dire the climate situation is. And I think that every forest is, every tree is sacred in a climate emergency.
Absolutely.
And while selective logging may have seemed like a solution, you know, now that we're in such a dire situation, you know, forests cool our planet. They stop bushfires, as I said. They prevent floods. And so, yeah, we really need to be protecting every single tree.
That's why I mentioned it, because I felt like it was really important to draw attention to listeners that you can't have any logging at all.
That's right, we can't have any logging at all. It looks like the call's going off.
They're just about to start. Thank you so much, Violet.
Really appreciate
it. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Marissa speaking with MC of yesterday's March for Forests rally, Violet Coco, about native logging and the state of native logging here in so-called Victoria and how corporations are getting around that and the government are getting around that through loopholes in legislation. We're now going to hear from Uncle Claude Douglas from Wadjabulluk Country, who's speaking about the ongoing impact of bushfires on his country a year after they started, as well as rare earths mining and the use of wind turbines. And of course, the failure of the Victorian government to take care of the land. Before I play this, I'll just give a very, very light language warning. Yeah, just in case, and I'll give you a little moment to switch off your radio. This interview airs for 15 minutes, so yeah, if you don't want to hear some very, very light swearing, then yeah, tune back in at 8:15. Here's Uncle Claude.
Ah, we all have a right to exist. And you could say the tree of life, water and the elements, family tree even. It has its roots. We're connected to land. It's all connected. It's all symbiotic. Even us humans are symbiotic. But since the Industrial Revolution and the exponential financial system, everything's a commodity. Even us people are commoditized. Ecocide is a worldwide issue for trees, water, land clearing. That was the first ecocide when they come here and colonise. I'm a black fella and they're tree fellas. You know? But it is what it is now, and they've got to protect what's left. I'm Wabalung, the lawman of my Wadjabulluk Nation, God's country. And up there at the moment, we've got these multinationals and conglomerates of all sorts coming in with zero net. It all sounds lovely putting up big turbines, and then you've got rare earths at the same time. And this Victorian government's absolutely criminal in giving a rare earths tenement and then fast track straight over that tenement VNI West transmission lines and things like that. And they all sound beautiful, these things, for the environment, but not when they're building them along our waterways, Yarrambiack Creek or my country. They're coming in really thick and fast, all fast track, all non-disclosure. Some our Aboriginal corporations, they're just like to sign off and stuff. It's just disgusting. And that's the Murray-Darling Basin. And these fires are a bit, you know, a bit sus. We just had 140,000 hectares from South Australia to over our country, Wajibalik. It's a big country. Our country goes over the South Australian border from Oyen all the way down to Garriwad. And it all just went up in the last bushfires, 140,000 hectares, and birds were falling out of the sky, our cockatoos, our totems, and all the emus, all that life, all she-oak. All the she-oak is just dead. And some areas will never recover in big and little deserts. Won't recover. And other areas, as the seeds are falling, there may be life. Then we've got our Wilcar dingoes, very rare out there. Everything's starving, all the lizards, you had to drop bark for cover so they could survive and breed. We had volunteers doing that. Then all the old she-oak was burning underground. It's still burning underground now, as we speak. And that was a year ago. And we still got these fires underground. And to me, what's going on here? You've got to question everything. They're after our water. They've been buying water up 10 years in advance. And then all of a sudden, kaboom, oh, we're doing rare earths, and the byproduct is uranium at Rupanyup, and everything in its way gets knocked down, and our old trees and the water gets done over by, what do you call it, there's fine plastics, or as it breaks down. And they're building them all along the Yarramvik Creek, all along over the Murray, and it's just like their path, there's our path, and everything in that path is just gone. And even on a cultural heritage perspective, all the artifacts being removed off these sites throughout black corporations, all middlemen and yes men, because they're corporate, not true to the word sovereign. And non-disclosure to its own members even. So we just had a 19-day inquiry by whatever her name is, either the Minister Ambrosio, whatever her name is. They called for it because of our discontent. The farmers want to save what's left up there and their properties, the trees, and these trees have even got protectionisms on it, but not with fast track. They'll rip them down. And it's just sad. There's so many things I want to say about trees. They're just so close to me. I'm protecting all our canoe trees and scar trees. And the waterways are getting eroded and they're just falling into the river bank, and they've been there for 800 years. But it's all the Murray-Darling Basin, and they're just going for everything, uranium, rare earths. I thought uranium was illegal or some sort of policy in Victoria, but the byproduct is at Rupanyup and the tailing ponds at Donald, big massive one. And it's not the only one, they're just going all over. If you look it up, the rare earths map, just all over the place. And everything in that path is at the detriment of animals, water, even with VNI West, transmission lines, they're a massive threat. And then big turbines, the Vortex, they're building all over our nations, even up to Garriwad, even up to Bunjil's Lalau Falls, even down the outskirts of Bunjil's Cave, they're everywhere. They're on the top of our Balags, our mountains and that. And what they do is the Vortex sucks the birds in. And then our Whirpals, our wedge-tailed eagles, are dead underneath them and other species. It's just like going through a maze. Or you try to put the brakes on, but the vortex pulls them in. And there's no decommissioning planned for them, 25 years life expectancy for them. There's no decommissioning because in 3 months another company can own them. It's just a monopoly. And we got the Chinese and the Trump mob all over our country. And probably other nations as I speak, but I'm just up there trying to stand up for my country. It's a bit of a lonely job, but I wouldn't trade it for anything else. So this 19-day inquiry was with Warwick Nobel Energy. It's like a big forest just popped up out of nowhere, the size of these towers here. They're double the size of them. just like War of the Worlds, you know, sort of thing. And they're promoted as being green and all that. And I think there's a bit of a conspiracy and all that, that big American politician for years, Al Gore, whatever his name is. And everything has an ulterior motive, and it's all based on dollars, even carbon and everything like that. Everything's just monopolizes bullshit. And it's sad when you own mob through corporations and whatever. Even treaties scaring me, because this is a business agreement with the state. It's bad enough now just with their own corporations, and then a big umbrella one over that. But that's for every corporation. That's bullshit, because all of Australia is just a big registered business anyway. It's just like in the world's mining spot run by criminals. And yous are all slaves too, and you don't know it. So only black fella sovereignty will rule this land, because all the sovereigns all around the world and the First Nations around the world, they're the ones that's saving the air we breathe at the moment. It's about 70% or something like that of destruction we prevent in doing so, as First Nations all over the world. So give them a big clap instead of these bloody Al Gore people and all that sort of shit. Yeah. So trees are just like our bodies. Nervous system, veins, emotions, feelings, holders of knowledge, which way the wind blows. Every tree tells a story. Even this one I got in my hand, probably one of the rarest woods in the world. Comes from the Mirren Nation and another connecting nation, I forget, out in the deserts of Western Australia where the sandalwood grows, and even the sandalwood's that threat. And this one here is illegal to harvest, is under protections, Western Australian government, and it's called Gimlet. And that's the actual tree itself. That's the root. And she just thrives. It's a eucalypt for moisture, usually the morning mist. And she just struggles and struggles to survive. And she just winds up. That makes it stronger. So it just pulls in, everything just pulls in and it twists. use rare wood like Wollombi pine. And the biggest threat is fire management. State of Victoria, they're criminal in that, even in the recommendations that we have burns, cultural burns, at 5%. Even that was their recommendation. At least 5% of Victoria's land mass will be culturally burned. Try like about 0.5. And a lot of farmers and that in these little towns and that, people look at the land and they think it's natural. It's not natural. They fed livestock and stuff like that. And this is a major cause of bushfires as well, and it's called African belt grass. And now farmers are growing other stuff, and this stuff's just feral. It's just all over the countryside. And it's that high, dry as, and in one little flick of a flame and it's just gone, everything's gone. And the land's not in its natural state. It's got a different surface normally with ground cover and all that. But yeah, it's their own fault. It's their farming practices and their feralness of the species and all that is a big contributor to fires out in country. Anyway, good on you, Bob Brown. You've been doing this stuff for a long time. And good on you, everyone that sticks with him. Fight for country, fight for water, fight for air, fight for sea, and fight for humanity and our animals. We all deserve to live and our creatures. We're not going to be at the detriment of these corporations and corrupt governments. Blackfella sovereignty never ever ceded from Blackfella nations.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That's a little brief clip of a song was from the Climate Choir Melbourne at yesterday's March for Forests, organised by the Bob Brown Foundation. And before that, you heard Uncle Claude Douglas from Wadjabaluk Country speaking at the same rally about the government's failure to take care of the land and the impacts of colonization on Wadjabaluk Country. We're going to keep going with another speech from the same rally. This one is from Phil Zylstra, who is an adjunct associate professor from Curtin University on fire behavior science, and he'll be speaking about how colonization has corrupted approaches to land care on this continent. Here's Phil.
Cahil Gibran said that trees are poems the earth writes on the sky. Trees are poems the earth writes on the sky. We fell them down and turned them into paper so that we can record our emptiness. When you see an area of forest that has been burnt in Victoria or elsewhere in eastern Australia, the reason it is being burnt is because there is a program that tells us if you burn this patch, you will save this many houses. That program is based on the idea that if you double something called the fuel load, you double the rate of spread of a fire, the speed that the fire spreads. So everything hinges on that idea. Now let me tell you a story about how forests have worked, because we need to come back to a reality check. Since Gondwana, our Australian forests have been filled with fire-sensitive species that have thrived. Long before humans walked this earth, there was a law that made these forests survive, and we can fit into this law. You see, something is fuel if it burns. If the mulch on the ground burns, then it's fuel. If that mulch can ignite the plants above it, then those plants are fuel. But if it doesn't ignite them, then the plants aren't fuel. During the black summer, 88% of the forests that burnt, the trees didn't burn. They weren't fuel, 88% of the time. And when they're not burning, they're affecting the fire because they're slowing the wind speed beneath them. So plants can either feed the fire as fuel, or they can slow and calm the fire as overstory shelter that slows the wind and creates that cool, moist microclimate. That's how a forest works. So how do plants get from being fuel into being overstory shelter? How does a forest change from something that is all fuel that feeds a fire into something that is a refuge that preserves species? Well, it doesn't need us to do that. It grows. Plants start small and get taller. It is in our colonizer minds that we think the world has to have us to take charge and be the managers and change it all. The forest works. We need to learn how to fit into that forest. The work that I've been doing now, we've looked at the fires that we've mapped across Australia. We haven't studied everywhere, but everywhere that we have studied, we've found the same trend. If you burn a forest, you get a few short years where you've got clear ground and fires stop. Then you've got decades where those plants are regrowing from the ground as fuel, becoming bigger and bigger, creating bigger and bigger flames until eventually they get to the point where they start becoming overstory shelter and the flames can't reach them anymore. And what we found is that all of the bushfires happen in the regrowth. We get people saying, in response to what I'm putting forward here, people will say, well, that's just a pipe dream. You can't get to these old forests anymore. We've got climate change. We've got everything's changed. You can't keep fire out for that long. The fire that was up at the Murray River there a couple of months ago, you know, the last bushfire that burnt that country there was a bit over 40 years ago. That means that if that country, if that forest had been left alone for that 40 years, it would have been in that long unburnt state that keeps fires small and keeps flames small. But it wasn't left alone. Between 10 and 15 years ago, there was a series of prescribed burns out there that lit it up, and so as a result, that fire took off in dense regrowth. We can live in this country. We can use fire in this country. First Nations knew how to use fire in this country, knew how to modify patches of ground so that you can garden what you need to do. But the whole key was to not be greedy bastards, to not take more than our share, to not try and change the whole landscape. You see, forests can create places of peace. I've come from Dharawal country this morning in the New South Wales south coast, Dharawal will have a tradition of an area that they call Yandellara. It means peace country. You can only get to Yandellara when certain trees there are allowed to be left alone. Those trees are killed by the smallest fire, but you create this peace country that is cool in summer, that stops fires. Yandellara stopped an arson-lit fire on the edge of Wollongong in the middle of the black summer. Nobody was there to do it. You don't survive for tens of thousands of years without knowing how this country works, without cooperating with this. We have got to wise up, because part of our colonizer thinking is that we have to take charge, we have to take control and fix things, and that if we don't, if we're locking up country, we call it, if we're leaving country alone, if we're doing nothing, that is offensive to us, because we've got this idea that unless you have changed country, then it is terra nullius. The forests know how to do their thing. We have got to learn to cooperate with them. Forests are fortresses that the earth builds to protect her children. We burn them down because we are afraid of any strength that we didn't create ourselves.
That was Phil Zylstra, adjunct associate professor from Curtin University and a fire behavior scientist, speaking at yesterday's March for Forests about how colonization has corrupted approaches to land care on this continent. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That song was called Real Life Love by Speed out of Gadigal Land. It is 8:28 and we've only got a few moments left of the Monday Breakfast Show for this week. So I'll just quickly remind listeners what we heard on the show, just in case you want to go back and listen to it on the podcast that we published. We first heard the second half of a conversation between Rosie Ganino and Alva Gigi about the founding of the Women's Action Committee and the general women's liberation movement in the 70s here in Nam. Then we heard a brief excerpt from the first episode of the podcast, What Children Know, produced by Alvy Swan here in Nam, speaking with children at Palestine rallies. And then we heard a few speeches from yesterday's March for Forests rally hosted by the Bob Brown Foundation, from Uncle Claude Douglas and Phil Zylstra. Both speaking about colonization and its impacts on the land across this continent. Thank you so much again to Marissa from the Doing Time Show for providing that audio, which brings us to the end of the show. So we will see you next week. Stay tuned for Women on the Line.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.